to the point at which Jacob is about to go out onto his own. In chapter 28, we see where, as a result of the blessing having been given by faith from Isaac to Jacob, he's now forced to flee his home. And Rebekah and Isaac had talked over the fact that the wife of Jacob must not come from the wives of the Canaanites, but in fact it would be prudent for Jacob to be sent back to Haran. And the events then in chapter 28 show that Jacob sets out on his own for the first time, and it doesn't read this way in 28. It reads rather easily. But there's a verse in Genesis 35 that points out the difficulties that this young man, Jacob, is going to face. And as we've mentioned already, God is going to be with him at every stage, but the difficulties he faced, nonetheless, are very, very real and very genuine. Because Jacob is leaving the security of his home. He's going to be on his own for the first time. He says later on in recounting the event that he was crossing the Jordan with just his staff. He's a young man alone. The first night, it's interesting to see this on exactly where he ends up. Most of his life is spent up till now down here in Beersheba, which is where Isaac is. The first night, he's going to cover the distance from Beersheba to Bethel. We pick up the text in verse 10 of chapter 28. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. It's 60 miles from Beersheba to Bethel. And we have the picture of a young man who is in distress. And the way it reads, he came to a certain place and stop there because the sun had set, leaves us with the impression that if the sun hadn't set, he'd have kept going. If you turn over to chapter 35, when Jacob is returning to Bethel after his time spent with Laban, God appears to him in verse 1, and he instructs him. He's been in Shechem, and he now needs to leave Shechem because of the death that his two sons have inflicted on the men of Shechem following the incident of Dinah and the circumcision. And God instructs him to go up to Bethel, and he recounts to his family, beginning in verse 1, God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." So Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, "Put away the foreign gods that are among you, and purify yourselves, and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, that I may make there an altar to the God who answered me in the day of my distress, and has been with me wherever I have gone." So the picture that we see in Genesis 35 is a young man who's on his own for the first time. He goes 60 miles the first day, and if the sun hadn't set, he would have kept going. But he comes to Bethel alone and afraid and in distress. And he prays to God. He lays himself down, and God appears to Jacob in the form of a vision, with the angel ascending and descending upon the ladder. The word really means a staircase. That's all we really need. That's all we really know about it. It wasn't a traditional ladder that we would think of, but it was some form of staircase, and the angels were ascending and descending upon this staircase. And if we look back in chapter 28, it says in verse 13 that the Lord stood above it, as it is in the RSV, and really if you look at the margin, the word should read, "The Lord stood beside it." There is the angel of the Lord standing beside Jacob, and he's now going to give him the assurance of the promises. And the whole point of this chapter will come out in verse 15. But before we get there, just take a look at some of the distressing situations in Jacob's life. This will be the first, not really the first, but this is one of many of the events that take place in Jacob's life. These are situations that are carefully designed by God to drive us to Him, not away from Him. The world looks at distressing situations, and they wonder how anyone can maintain their faith in God in light of the circumstances. That's not how God uses distressing situations. It's not how He used them in the life of Jacob. Each of the ones listed here were designed by God to drive Jacob closer to God, not away from Him. And these types of situations are common occurrences among all of the redeemed, among all of the faithful, because God can't work with a man who has all the answers. And a man or a woman in a distressing situation does not have all the answers. Jacob was a man who thought he had all the answers to every situation, whether it be in the matter of the birthright, the matter of the blessing, and we'll see later on with the matters arising in the household of Laban. But God will introduce distressing situations into his life, and He introduces them into our life, because God can work best with us when we are in distressing situations. In some cases, we would consider them impossible situations. You look at the life of Joseph for just a minute. I'll turn this off for a second. I know it will be thanks on the light. It may be dangerous to leave the lights off too long this afternoon, so we'll stay with that. But you look at the life of Joseph, and I count five times that Joseph was put in an impossible situation. From the fact that his brothers hated him, and he has to grow up in that hatred, and then God gives him the dream. Picture that. You're Joseph in that household. You're hated by your brothers because of your father's love for you, because of your love for the truth. And what does God do to that situation? He gives you dreams. And what do those dreams reinforce? More hatred by your brothers. You see, God doesn't always deliver us from difficult situations. Oftentimes, He'll make the situations even worse. Worse from the natural perspective. Spiritually edifying from a spiritual perspective. Joseph is then thrown in the pit by his brother. Another impossible situation. Thrown in the pit to die and leave him there. Because that's what 10 of them wanted to do. But then he's sold into slavery. Sold into slavery into Egypt. Alone with only his God in prison in Egypt. Another impossible situation. That probably for most of us, at that age, at any age, would destroy us. It would be more than our faith could handle. And it's the reason that God doesn't put us in that situation if we're not able to handle it. But it doesn't get any better. Because then he has the incident of Potiphar's wife. There isn't a brother in this hall today that can look at that situation and marvel at the faith of Joseph in that circumstance. Another impossible situation. But he trusted to his God and he did what was right. As a result, put into prison. And there he stays. The baker and the butler have their dreams. And he tells them what's going to happen. And surely now is my chance and my opportunity to be relieved from this prison. And what happened? He waits 2 whole years, as the account in Genesis has it. Because God is not yet done working with Joseph's faith, perfecting his faith. Marvelous example of distressing, yea, impossible situation in the life of a faithful man that God was designing. And he's doing the same thing with Jacob in each of the distressing situations he faced. Now, which one of these would we like to endure? Would you like to grow up for 50 years in the household of Isaac and Rebekah with Esau as your older brother? Knowing that your father loves him and not you, painful enough, difficult enough to endure. Esau seeks his life, so he must flee. He's forced to flee home, and his first night is a distressing night for him. And he prays to God to deliver him. And because of the level of faith that he's attained, God has to step right in and help him out. Because Jacob at this point is not far enough along in his development of faith to make it one more night without the angel of the Lord appearing to him to rest assured that God will work with him. And we won't go through all of these, but there's 13 very, very difficult situations in Jacob's life. Whether it be the difficulties he's had with his family, living under Laban's influence, as we'll see in a few minutes, his return trip with Esau, and the difficulties that his sons placed him in, the difficulty with Joseph, and then the trial he has with watching Simeon first taken, and then having to willingly offer Benjamin. All of these are distressing situations. But Jacob is learning to live by faith, and God uses each of these situations to teach him. So, brothers and sisters, it is the same way in our life. God introduces situations in our life that are designed to draw us towards him, not away from him, if we are spiritual men and women, because spiritual men and women are driven to God, not away from him, and they can see the providential hand at work. The rest of the world, hoping to endure. Spiritual men and women see the hand of God at work in their lives, teaching us the need to wait upon God, teaching us that we cannot deliver ourselves from sin. We cannot deliver ourselves from the things that God needs to accomplish in us. We can't accomplish those on the strength of our own ability. But God appears to Jacob in this chapter, and he gives him the assurance that he is going to be with him. Jacob's prayer is answered by the angels, by the vision of the angels ascending and descending on the staircase. And that's really the whole point of chapter 28. We won't spend any more time in there, but just look at verse 15, for instance. God is telling Jacob, he's giving him the assurance that he'll be with him and that he will bring him back. Verse 15 reads, "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that of which I have spoken to you." And that's the message he's giving to this young man, Jacob, on his way as he departs his family and his kindred in the security of his home and goes out now, first night on his own, and he will spend years and years under Laban's direction, under Laban's tutorship, as it were. Because what's happening is Jacob is no longer going to be taught by Rebekah. Jacob now is going to be instructed by Laban. Not that Laban is a spiritual teacher, but Laban is going to teach Jacob an awful lot about his own character. We're going to see that Jacob sees in Laban many of the very things that he needs to eradicate from his own life. And Laban is a very effective teacher in that respect. But notice too in verse 15, Jacob, "I am the one doing the work. I will be with you and will not leave you until I have accomplished that which I have spoken to you." And this theme of God assuring Jacob is repeated several more times. You don't have to lower those out of the bank. I've just included this insert. You can go back and Bible mark it. I found it helpful. But just a quick summary of how often this theme shows up again. Because remember, God is trying to teach Jacob to wait upon him continually. And he does so by giving him the assurance at the outset now, because really what's happening is Jacob is going to begin his spiritual life with God. When he wakes up in the morning following this vision, Jacob is a man, not a new man, but a man now equipped and prepared to go on a very long journey, wherein he'll just have himself and his God to rely on. And God's assurance at the outset is that he would be with Jacob, he would bring him back, and we've captured that by the phrase, "I am with you and will keep you wherever you go." And the phrase shows up several more times in Jacob's life. In response to the vision, Jacob wakes up the following morning, and he makes his vow in verse 20. And I might just point out, there's a couple ways to read the vow. One I would call a conditional one, the other one I would call a responsive one. And though at first reading, it looks like Jacob is saying, if God will do this, then he will be my God. And there is another way to read that, and that is more of a responsive vow. And I really think that's what Jacob is doing here. Because if this is a conditional vow, in other words, if God will do this for me, yeah, I'll do this over here for him. You don't see the vision of the angels ascending and descending upon a ladder and having God speak to you and give you the assurance that he will be with you wherever you go and wake up the next morning and say, yeah, if you'll do this for me, I'll do that for you. Read it from the standpoint that Jacob is saying in response to what he's seen. Boy, if God is going to do this for me, then he is going to be my God. And I think that's the spirit of the response of Jacob. Not a conditional vow he makes. It's a responsive vow. Brothers and sisters, it ought to be the same vow each of us can make. If we have the assurance of the promises, if we have the assurance that God is going to be with us in every phase of our life, then like Jacob, God ought to be our Lord. And we ought to trust to him for all of our needs. So Jacob sets out then from Padan Aram. And on the next slide is the natural character that is evident in Jacob upon his arrival in Padan Aram. Really, verse chapters 26 and 27 show us the character of Jacob in his infancy as a heel catcher, as a supplanter. This is the character with which God is going to work and shape and mold and direct. He's got a great deal of confidence in himself and his own ability. He desires to be united with Rebekah's family, as we see in the first several verses of chapter 29. When he arrives in Padan Aram, he's looking for Laban's household. And when it's evident that he's come across them, and in verses 9, 10, 11, and 12, for instance, he comes to the well, and he sees the sheep there. And as he's speaking, Rachel comes up with her father's sheep. And then in verse 10, now when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And we have a picture there, and that rolling of the stone is such an excellent example of the man Jacob at this point. Because he arrives there, and he is so happy and so enthusiastic and excited about being able to join himself to this family of his mother's brother, that in his enthusiasm, he goes out and he rolls this rock away, because I have found where I want to go. And in the strength of his own might, he does what several other shepherds were not able to do, as the account reads earlier. They were kind of waiting for everyone to get there and then roll the stone away to water the sheep. But Jacob goes out and does that himself. He's confident in his own ability. He's seeking to be united to this family. And as we're going to see, by the time he's done, he's going to leave the ways of Syria behind. And he's going to learn the lesson of the need to leave the ways of the Syrian way of life behind. And lastly, he shows up as a schemer and a deceiver. Now, our natural reaction when we hear the word schemer or scheme is to think of somebody who is cutting some deal in a back room, of somebody with wicked, evil intentions that's trying to satisfy their own needs and make sure they come out on top and everybody else there's no regard for. And the word scheme here, and I'm going to use it several times, has got I'm intending to use it with a much broader definition. Because Jacob was a schemer. And maybe what you could do, if you would, on your notes, is just write in the definition. Because a schemer, from God's perspective, scheming occurs, any time we trust in our own ability first. And there's all kinds of scheming that we do, brothers and sisters. This isn't just, reserved for the few incidents, for the scheming type people that are always working in the background, trying to manipulate events to their own benefit. A schemer, in this context, like Jacob was, happens any time we're trusting to our own ability first, and then we expect God to come along afterwards and kind of fill in the pieces. And that's really what Jacob's character was all about at this stage. He was a schemer. It's not necessarily something that's done behind someone's back, but it happens every time we trust in our own ability first and then seek God's help. And I've captured some of the examples of scheming, and we all do it. And we all do it all of the time. We see a situation where there's a problem, and we think we have an answer, and we pray to God to make sure that our answer is right, and then we go on. And we've got too much of ourselves involved in the solution before we've ever asked God to participate. And that was Jacob's problem. He'd look at a situation, and he'd come up with an answer, and then he would hope God would bless his efforts. And God is going to teach Jacob that you cannot save yourself. You cannot approach life in that manner and still glorify me. You see, the problem with scheming is it precludes us from seeing the providential hand of God at work in our life. And we are too quick to take credit for our own ability. Someone has a problem, and they develop a solution and seek God's blessing upon that solution. And they are involved in that solution to such an extent that they will inevitably share in the glory of the solution. Anytime we come out of a situation feeling pretty good about ourselves, we've probably been involved in scheming to one extent or another. So that's the scope of scheming. It looks for shortcuts. It encourages overconfidence in one's own ability, captured by the concept of we plan now and we pray later. We try to control events and outcomes. And number seven there, problems and trials can be avoided if the right steps are taken. That's what a scheming life is all about. That's Jacob's perspective at this stage of development in his faith. And God is going to demonstrate to him that was not a right way of living. We just captured some of the schemings of Jacob in terms of the birthright, involved in the deceit of Isaac regarding the blessing, even in his desire to serve 7 years for Rachel. He shows up on the scene, he falls in love immediately with Rachel, and he goes, yeah, 7 years, I'll serve 7 years for her, not a problem at all. Does he seek God's blessing, and God's insight, and God's guidance in the matter of marrying Rachel? No, he doesn't. Is Rachel a beneficial spiritual influence on that family? Hardly, as we'll see in a few minutes. But there he is, working out his scheme. 7 years for Rachel? Yeah, I can do that. Later on, he peels the fresh rods to secure the flocks will be his. And there he is. When the flocks come for the mating season, he's got this whole scheme developed. And God eventually has to tell him, Jacob, that wasn't you doing it at all. He shows him a vision. That was my hand at work. That wasn't your hand at work. And he's teaching Jacob that his schemes are of absolutely no value. He flees Laban in secrecy in chapter 31, and then prior to meeting Esau, he is separating his family and all his flocks to the droves, and he's going to present these five different presents, as it were, as we'll see tomorrow morning, to Esau. Again, more scheming, because he's trying to come up with the solution, and then add to that solution a divine blessing, and somehow that's all going to work. Brothers and sisters, it doesn't work that way. If we're taking our own ability putting it together with God's blessing and mixing them all together, all we're doing is scheming. All we're doing is providing an end product or developing an end product where God gets some of the glory and we get some of the glory. And God is going to teach Jacob that is not the basis upon which my righteousness is going to be extended to the faithful. It has got to be God only. So as Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 1, that there be no glory in the flesh. Any other basis here is glory to the flesh, and that was at the heart of Jacob's scheming problem, is not acceptable before the Lord. Now, for those of us who are involved in the business world, I suggest that is an excellent arena in which scheming takes place. And I'm not talking about deals that are cut, or dishonesty, or underhandedness. There may be an element of that. I'm talking about a situation where on a daily basis, the brethren or sisters involved in that kind of environment, on a daily basis, in a business situation, a person is encouraged to come up with solutions to problems that they face. In fact, the ones who can come up with the best solutions are rewarded, usually with more money, usually with higher positions of responsibility, to develop more complex answers to more difficult solutions. The business world is a beehive of activity for scheming. And again, I'm not talking about dishonesty. I'm not talking about cutting deals or any of those things. It can be done with the utmost of integrity. And yet it's a condition where the flesh is glorified. And it's part and parcel to the business world we face today. Jacob would have made an excellent businessman because he had a very clear mind to think through situations. And that's really what the business world rewards, those who have the clear mind, who can come up with a solution. And we have brethren, myself included, 5 days of the week. That's the environment we live in. And brethren, if we're not careful, it can be the spiritual end of us. Because God is teaching Jacob, as God needs to teach us, that he alone is the one to whom the glory belongs. And this way of life that we participate, if we are not careful, is going to reinforce this idea that we can come up with solutions ourselves. And boy, you know, Mr. Stiles, that was an excellent idea you had. And you did a real good job over here. And boy, we want to reward you for this over here. And it would be the spiritual end of us, brethren, or sisters, or anyone who's involved in it, if we allow that way of life to influence us spiritually. It's an unfortunate situation that we're in. It's a situation not unlike some of the difficult situations Jacob was in, but it's one we need to be aware of and be mindful of, because if we're not, it can envelop us. It can overcome us, deluding us. And we can do it with the utmost of honesty, and we can do it with the highest amount of integrity. But that's what the curse of the business world is, as I refer to it, because it's a world full of scheming. Scheming from the standpoint of it encourages men and women to come up with a solution and praises them for it, as opposed to realizing that all glory belongs to God. A sober warning to each of us that are involved in it on a regular basis. But the man Jacob is just what, I'm sorry, the man Laban is just what Jacob needs. Because he comes to Syria, he comes to Padan Aram, with the three natural characteristics as we saw. And this man Laban, and we tried to capture some of this in this slide, he is lazy, he's a lover of money, he's a scoundrel, he's a despicable father, and he is a lying cheat. And that's on one of his good days. Turn over, for instance, in chapter 31. This man is incredible. And you know, just marvelous how God brings Laban into his life. Exactly what Jacob needs. This is at the end of his stay in Padan Aram. Jacob goes out and talks to Rachel and Leah and says, I've had a vision from God. The angel told me it is time to leave. And now here is the assessment of the two daughters of their own father. Verse 15 of chapter 31. Verse 14. Then Rachel and Leah answered him, is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Normally, when a daughter was married off, it was customary for the father to give her part of the inheritance. They didn't get a piece. Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has been using up the money given for us. All the property which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do. And that was the daughter's assessment of this man Laban. He had sold them, he had taken the proceeds, and now he was busily enjoying the proceeds and living off the proceeds to himself, to his own satisfaction. Turn back to chapter 30 for another insight into Laban's character. 6 years before Jacob is to leave Padan Aram. He sits down. Joseph has just been born. We're not going to have time to go through all the events, so we'll kind of hopscotch between chapters 29, 30, and 31. Jacob says to Laban, after Joseph is born, "It's time for me to leave." In verse 25, Rachel had borne Joseph. Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own home and country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know the service with which I have given you." And Laban says, "Now wait a minute, Jacob." See, Laban is the kind of man, he knows that he has done quite well by Jacob being under his household. And he convinces Jacob to stick around, which Jacob agrees to do. He says, "Jacob, you name your price. You name your price, and that'll be your wage. Only don't leave me right now." So the agreement they reach is that Jacob will get all the spotted and speckled of the flock, and Laban will get all of the non-spotted and speckled, their pure color. And Laban says, "Great idea. I can do that," is what Laban says. Look down in verse 34. After they've reached this agreement that Jacob would just take the speckled and the spotted, or the ring-straked, as it is in the Authorized Version, Laban says, "Good, let it be as you have said," being the businessman that he is. Because you see, he's got his own scheme in the back of his mind. That day, verse 35, Laban removed the he-goats that were striped and spotted, and all the she-goats that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, and every lamb that was black, and put them in charge of his sons, and he set a distance of 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob, and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. So not only does he strike this deal with Jacob, but he says, "Jacob, great deal. I'll agree to it completely." And that night, he goes through, and he takes out everyone from the flock that belongs to Jacob. He separates them, he gives them to his sons, and he takes them off 3 days' journey. So Jacob begins with none in his flock. That's the kind of man Laban was. Now as time unfolds, Laban's flock will become Jacob's flock because of God's handiwork, and because Laban will change his wages 10 times. It will get to the point eventually where Jacob possesses nearly all of Laban's flock. But that's the kind of man Laban was. Almost unbelievable in his scheming, and in this case, his diabolical ways of trying to make sure that he benefited while Jacob was suffering the consequences. But Laban is useful from another standpoint too, because this will demonstrate the fact of God working through Laban to teach Jacob. And we can bring the lights back up if we would. Thank you. You go back to the incident of Leah and Rachel. Jacob is 7 years in the land, and he runs into his own brick wall, just like Isaac did. And look how it unfolds. In verse 15 of chapter 29, Jacob agrees to work for Laban. In verse 16, we read that Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel's were beautiful and lovely. And Jacob immediately falls in love with Rachel. And the Hebrew there actually says that Rachel was beautiful of form and beautiful of appearance. In other words, she was beautiful from head to toe. And this is the one that Jacob immediately falls in love with. Now, notice though the parallels between Laban's deceit of Jacob and how Jacob had been involved in the deceit of Isaac. And what God is teaching him is the need to eliminate deceit in his life. Because when Jacob goes in to Rachel on their wedding night, down in verse 25, verse 23 for connection, in the evening, this is after the 7 years, Jacob has said, "Give me now Rachel my wife." A feast is held, and in the evening, Laban took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah to be her maid. And in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And Jacob said to Laban, What is this that you have done to me? Did I not serve with you for Rachel? Why then have you deceived me? And notice the similarities between this deceit and the deceit that Jacob had been involved in with the matter of Isaac. In the first place, you've got a lie being told about the younger and the older. And it was the result of that lie that led to the deceit. Isaac is blind and is able to be deceived because of his blindness. In the middle of the night, Jacob is deceived by the darkness and never realizes it's Leah until the morning. Rebecca and Jacob worked together in this deceit, as did in the deceit of Isaac, as did Leah. She must have worked with Laban in this matter, because Laban couldn't have carried this out without Leah's participation. And finally, just as Jacob thought he was getting the younger and ended up with the older, Isaac thought he had been blessing the older and was in fact blessing the younger. So right off the bat, Jacob has a clear lesson to him about the place of deceit and the danger of deceit and using this deceit to accomplish his own purposes. Because in this case, he's on the other end of such a situation. And let me just offer a word here too. You know, sometimes you hear when this is read over, and we talk about these incidents, that somehow God is paying Jacob back for his being involved in the deceit of his father. Brothers and sisters, God does not deal in paybacks. We won't take the time now, but when you read through Hebrews 12 and the chastening and the discipline and the punishment that God brings into our life, he isn't telling Jacob, well, because you were involved in the deceit of Isaac, I'm going to pay you back and get one over on you. God doesn't work that way. We may work that way, but God doesn't work that way. All of the difficult situations that we face are designed purposely, as Paul says in Hebrews 12, because God loves us and is chastening us and is teaching us and is molding our characters so that we can share in the divine nature. We can share in his glory. So even in this situation here, God is not undertaking and not controlling these events, such as Jacob ends up with Leah instead of Rachel, for no other reason than to teach Jacob that deceit has no place in the life of a believer. In terms of deceit, where you're trying to get something that doesn't belong to you. Let me just add that caveat, lest your mind go back to the situation with Rebecca being involved in the deceit of Isaac. There was nothing Rebecca had to gain from deceit. Rebecca is involved in the deceit of Isaac, but there's nothing that she's going to gain from. So we may deceive one another because we're trying to get something that we don't have. That was not the case with Rebecca. We won't take the time now, but the idea of deceit is a moral term. If we try to define God in terms of deceit and Rebecca's activity, you know, deceit is something we've said is not proper to be used. You go back and look at the case, and Brother Roberts in The Ways of Providence does an excellent job of discussing the deceit that was active in Rebecca's life, or at least in the incident of Isaac. And I would recommend that each of us interested go back and read through that section. But the deceit that Jacob is involved in is a case of where he's trying to get something that through a means that is deceitful, that is diabolical, and God is showing that there's no place for this in the life of a believer. Now, in verse 16 and 17, we saw that Jacob is attracted to Rachel and not to Leah. And she is the beautiful one from head to toe. And it's interesting how Jacob's love for Rachel is the same mistake that Isaac made with Esau. You know, lest we say Esau had this spiritual blindness that I will never have, along comes Jacob. And for the same reasons Isaac loved Esau, because of the apparent strength of his character, Jacob is attracted to Rachel. And we're going to see in Rachel's character that she was not a spiritual woman, though Leah was. And here is Jacob committing the same situation, or thrusting himself into the same situation, where the natural ability, in this case her beauty, is what Jacob found so attractive. Leah, on the other hand, if you turn over to chapter 29, and this really shows the depth of Leah's spirituality, when it's quite evident that Jacob loves Rachel and not Leah, Leah is the one that begins to produce the children, and her offspring come first. And if you go through and you look at the names and see how Leah makes the connection with God, faced with the lack of love and appreciation and warmth from her own husband, Leah turns her attention and her focus upward. And Reuben is born. In verse 32, God has opened her womb. Reuben is born, and Leah gives God, says, "Because the Lord has looked upon my affliction, surely now my husband will love me." So she makes a direct connection between Reuben being born and God having blessed her. And then Simeon is born. In verse 33, she conceived again and bore a son and said, "Because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also." So a marvelous testimony to Leah's character. Here she is, definitely the second fiddle in this family now that has four women. And because Jacob was unwilling to take Leah as his wife, and he said instead he wanted Rachel, and he served the extra week for her, he's now got four women in his household that will produce no ends of turmoil and difficulties within that household. And all of the hatred and the animosity, that kind of a situation would normally flow. But there is Leah, trusting to the Lord, turning to the Lord in the face of the fact that in verse 30, we read that Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. Now, how could Jacob make the same mistake as Isaac? Quite simple, unfortunately. It shows us, and I think herein is a good lesson for each of us. It's a lesson that needs to be learned by every generation, because one generation can't learn it for the next generation. It needs to be learned by every brother and sister, because a husband can't learn it for a wife, or vice versa. And that lesson is that we have to ultimately make a choice between those things in our life that are natural and those things in our life that are spiritual. And it shows in the case of Isaac selecting Esau and Jacob selecting Rachel how strong that attraction is that draws us to the accomplishments of the flesh. We can either choose the things of the Spirit or we can choose the things of the flesh. In the case of our own lives, we can choose careers and occupations that will advance the material goods that the world has to offer, or we can choose careers and occupations that will encourage the things that we're trying to accomplish in the truth. When it comes to material goods, we can either acquire those because it will allow us to keep up with what everybody else has, or we can acquire those goods that will best be used in the ecclesial world and best serve the brethren and sisters in the ecclesia. We can spend money in one of two ways. We can spiritually spend it to make sure the best or the most are able to be edified by it, or we can spend our money in such ways that we will, first and foremost, benefit from it. And young people, it's the same situation in the friends that we choose in the world. We can choose friends that are attractive, that can go to places that are enjoyable to go to, that advance all the feelings of the flesh, or we can choose to associate and have our friendship with those young people in the CYC. In every case, brethren and sisters and young people, what the world has to offer by the world standard will be more attractive than what the truth has to offer by the world standard. Let me say it again. In every case, what the world has to offer will be more attractive by the world standards. If we compare the things of the world versus the things of the truth, and the world standards are our basis for comparison, there will always be prettier young ladies out in the world. Always. You'll always find a more attractive friend out in the world, or a good-looking fella. That's always the case if that's our standard. And you can go right down the line. When we make our choices and our comparisons, it is vital that we make our choices and make our decisions based on the truth standards. Because only then is it evident how shallow and how hollow and how of no substance what the world has to offer, how utterly despicable and how much of a bowl of pottage that decision really is. But if we let ourselves use the standards of the world and deceive ourselves into thinking that's how we ought to make our choices, the world will win every time. The Rachels of the world will always be prettier, they'll always be more attractive, and they will always be fancier in their appeal to us if we're using the world standards and making those decisions, if that's where our heart is. Now, we're going to skip through chapter 30, and we're going to pass considerable time in Jacob's life, because I want to get to the point in his life when he is preparing to leave Syria. At the end of the years, and I've included in the chart, I won't take the time now, but there's one school of thought that talks about him being there 20 years, and there's one school of thought that talks about him being 40 years. And that comes from chapter 31, when he talks about being in Laban's household, you know, for 20 years. He mentions it twice. And let me just say that the chart is developed in the booklet on the thinking along the lines that he was actually there 40 years. I won't go into the time now. If you want to talk about it later, we can. But you follow through the events that are included in chapter 30 and 31, and the number of children born, for instance, in Leah's case, and the fact that Esau went to visit Ishmael to get a daughter from Ishmael when he saw that Jacob was sent off to Padan Aram. It seems to me that the weight of evidence comes down on the fact that he was there 40 years, but it's not a point that I want to be too strong on. I just wanted to make sure you're aware of that in the notes and as you go through them in the chronological exhibit there. But Jacob now is preparing to leave Syria, and he has learned many significant lessons in Laban's household, and Jacob will leave a different man. Notice, for instance, in chapter 31, Jacob leaves Padan Aram no longer confident in his own ability. For instance, in verse 5, after the Lord has appeared to him and told him to return to his own land, he sends and calls Rachel and Leah into the field where his flock was, in verse 40, and said to them, I see that your father does not regard me with favor as he did before, but the God of my father has been with me. Again in verse 7. Let's read 6 for connection. You know that I have served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not permit him to harm me. Jacob has come to see that God has played a very active role in his life, and he gives God the credit for that which was accomplished. A key lesson that he's learned. He's seen the hand of God at work in his life, and the fact that God has accomplished things that Jacob never could have accomplished. We see, too, that Jacob has learned that the Syrian ways are not God's ways. Notice the simple situation of just proper conduct in our living. Jacob is very interested in reflecting and demonstrating righteousness in all that he does. Turn back in verse 30, in chapter 30, for instance. Now, chapter 30 is 6 years before he leaves, but it's another indication of what Jacob has learned in Syria. After he tells Laban, here is the agreement we'll have between the two types of sheep, he says, my righteousness, in verse 33, or honesty, as it is in the Revised Standard Version, will answer for me later when you come to look into my wages with you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and black among the lambs, if found with me, shall be counted stolen. So Jacob is very careful to make sure that in all of his dealings, he dealt with the utmost of honesty and integrity. This idea comes across again in verse 38 of chapter 31. This is where Laban now has caught up with him as he has fled. Laban was 3 days removed, and Laban's eventually caught up with Jacob as he's fleeing him. And in verse 38, Jacob recounts, these 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your she-goats have not miscarried, and I have not eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn by wild beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. Of my own hand you required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. So we have the picture of a man who has learned to uphold integrity and honesty and righteousness in all of his dealings.
He is no longer dealing from deceit. He is no longer dealing from how can I best advance my own cause in this situation. He has learned the need for these basic elements of righteousness in his dealings with Laban. And these were difficult working conditions. Look, for instance, in verse 40 of chapter 31. Thus I was by day, the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. For this period of time that Jacob has been in Syria has not been an easy situation. You know, and I'm not sure what our own situation is at work. Sometimes we have bosses that advance the things in the truth and can appreciate and are sensitive to our lives in the truth. Sometimes we have working conditions where that's not the case, and it is very difficult for us to endure week by week. Jacob did not have an easy life in Syria. His sleep left him by night. He'd have to go out and protect the flock. The cold came to him by night, and the heat consumed him during the day. So these were not easy years that Jacob lived under. But in all of them, God proved to Jacob that his scheming was of no value. And as we've mentioned, when that incident with the flocks, and the flocks being transferred from Laban to Jacob, he initially thinks it's because of what he's doing. But in chapter 32, God recounts to him that it wasn't you, Jacob. It was my hand at work in the matter of the flocks, making sure that the flocks were transferred each generation that passed from Laban to yourself. And notice, too, that Jacob has learned that he doesn't need to take anything that doesn't belong to him. A simple lesson. He didn't go out and take Laban's flock. God gave it to him. And there's another lesson that Jacob learned in that flock. He starts out, as you recall, with none. And by the time he leaves, he has so much of Laban's flock. Look, for instance, in chapter 31. He has so much now of Laban's flock that Laban's sons are envious, and Jacob becomes unsettled. Jacob heard that the sons of Laban were saying, "Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has gained all this wealth." You see, brethren and sisters, oftentimes in Jacob's life, a situation at one point is preparing Jacob for a situation later on. God is showing Jacob in Laban that he can start out with none in the flock, and God can provide him a flock. There will come a time later on in Jacob's life, because of the loss of Joseph, where there are none in the flock. His sons are all with him. Judah is off performing wickedness. Judah's sons are so wicked that God has to slay him. Reuben is involved in taking Bilhah, Jacob's concubine. Leah and Simeon are involved in the incidents of Shechem. Jacob is left with no spiritual flock later on in his life. But he doesn't despair. He trusts his God, and just as God raised up a flock for Jacob and paid an errand, God is able to raise up a flock for Jacob, a spiritual flock, later on in his life. It's a marvelous story, those events of chapter 37 to 42, and how the brethren moved from men who were Esau types to Jacob types. Jacob is working with them year after year. And it's a marvelous story when Judah is confronted with the situation in Egypt. And Benjamin's life is on the line and stands before that man in Pharaoh, that man second in command to Pharaoh. And Judah tells this man, who he doesn't know is Joseph, when Joseph says he's going to keep Benjamin, Judah turns to him and he says, "I cannot make my father go through the difficulties that I saw him go through when he lost Joseph. I will take the place of Benjamin." And the spiritual level of development that occurred in those 11 sons was truly astounding. An incredible example of the natural sons of Jacob being brought through the life of development So what was happening in Jacob's life eventually happens in the sons of his, in the lives of his sons. But there was a time when there were none, just like there was a time when there were none of his flock, and yet God, working through Jacob, was able to raise up a spiritual seed. So we come to the final point I'd like to cover today. We won't go through the slide on Rachel, but it's there for you to examine. She was not a spiritual woman. She hated her sister. She was envious of Leah's children. She was Esau-like in her actions when she finally turns to Jacob and she says, "Give me children or I shall die." Boy, that is straight out of Esau's book, isn't it? And Jacob turns to her and he says, "Who do you think I am, God, that I can give you children?" But that was the kind of woman that Rachel was. And yet, Jacob still loved her for some of the same reasons that Isaac loved Esau. But the final point I wanted to cover was this one contained here on Jacob's progression of faith. Because what we see in Jacob leaving Padan Aram is the fact that Jacob is a different man. His character is slowly changing. It's taken years to get to the point where he is now willing to trust in God in matters regarding the flock. He's willing to reflect honesty and righteousness in his day-to-day conduct. And he is very careful to make sure that he doesn't take anything that doesn't belong to him. These are really some of the beginning stages of our spiritual development in the truth. That's what Jacob learned in Padan Aram. As we'll see tomorrow in the lesson of Peniel, Jacob will learn to have power not in himself, but to have power in God. We don't have time in this study, but I have included this for you to take the time to go through. There are many more significant events in Jacob's life. Each of them are taking him to the next level of faith, the next progression of faith. And brothers and sisters, what we see in these situations is that as Jacob's faith develops, God takes him to the next level, and each time those trials and those difficulties required to take him to the next level become more painful, become more difficult, become more challenging, they become more complex. By their very nature, if you took the time to read through those, you would see. To give up Joseph, rather to lose Joseph, was far more painful and required a much larger level of faith than the trials that Jacob faced early in his life. But you follow that account through, and eventually Jacob is willing to give Benjamin. Joseph was taken from him without his involvement. Jacob is willing to give Benjamin. And he says, "If I am bereaved of my children, I will be bereaved." And that isn't a father who is just throwing his arms up and saying, "Well, I've got no control over this. If this is what God requires in my life, then take Benjamin." At first, he wouldn't send him. When they come back and they say, "We need to take Benjamin back with us," you are not taking him. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and I've only one left. Benjamin is the only one left showing any signs of spirituality. The famine gets worse, and Jacob finally realizes this is necessary, and he sends Benjamin down to Egypt in faith that God would see him through this and would develop out of his sons that which God needed to accomplish. A marvelous testimony to the fact that God is developing Jacob step by step, incident by incident. And as these situations become more complex and more difficult and more challenging, you know what else is happening? Jacob's ability to resolve them is diminishing. Because they are so difficult, Jacob is learning, "I cannot do it myself. There is no solution I can even dream up to save Benjamin." And off he goes. There was no solution he could dream up to save the family in the case of losing Joseph. So as each of these situations come along, there's a pattern. And it's a very sobering pattern, brothers and sisters. Because what it means is as our faith is strengthened, the challenges that lie ahead will be more difficult than the challenges we faced in the past. But, and that's why we've labeled it the progression, there ought to be a progression of faith in our lives. What bothered us before shouldn't bother us today. Some of the incidental things of life, sometimes the way people treat us, sometimes the situations that we find ourselves in, they bother us when we're young. They oughtn't bother us as our years develop.